At Audi Columbus, luxury meets convenience. Family-owned since 1897, we've built our reputation on trust, transparency, and innovation. Browse our selection online and complete your purchase from home. Then simply stop by to pick up your keys.
Drive home a new 2025 Audi Q6 e-tron for $569 for 36 months with $45.35 down.
The next generation shops online. Experience the future with us at AudiColumbus.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 7/30/25.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. A quick explanation for those of you who might not know what a case updates episode is. It's basically where I go back through all of the cases I've covered over the last 8 years on my channel and see if there are any updates that are worth me sharing with you. So today we've got some Doe identifications, we've got a big update in the case of the Lisk, we've got an update in Jalik Rainwalker's case, in the Menendez brothers, and so much more. So if you want to hear about all of that, stick around. And we are going to start with Julie Doe. I am very excited to start by sharing that Julie Doe has finally been identified as Pamela Lee Walton. There are a few stories I've covered on this channel that have really stuck with me over the years, stories that you guys also seem to relate to me, as you will come straight to me with any updates. And ever since I first covered this case a couple of years ago, I have followed this so closely. I've kept an eye on every single update from the DNA Doe Project, and I wondered if they would ever be able to finally reunite Julie, as she was known at this point, with her identity, and they were. Pamela was a transgender woman found deceased in Claremont in Florida in 1988, possibly found months after her death. She was originally assumed to be a cisgender woman until DNA testing in 2015 revealed a Y chromosome, suggesting that the Doe was trans and was either in the process of or had completed transitioning. She had undergone surgery, she had silicone breast implants, and had possibly had a rhinoplasty, nose surgery, maybe as part of a facial feminization surgery. The reveal that she was trans immediately added another layer of complication to finding her identity, even once her case was taken on by the DNA Doe Project in 2019. There was every chance, even if they were able to find Pamela's family and birth name, that was not going to line up with her chosen name. There was also the chance that she had been disowned by her family, being transgender in the 1980s, and that they wouldn't have known her at this stage in her life. But the DNA Doe Project teamed up with the Trans Doe Task Force in determination to find her identity through genetic genealogy. And after 5 years, they were able to narrow down the family tree to the correct branch. Team co-leader Eric Hendershot said, "The team faced just about every possible hurdle, from unknown parentage, matches who were adopted, to endogamy. Even up to the end when we suspected that she was adopted, the team was stuck." So on top of the fact that Julie was trans, which added complications, they also discovered that she had likely been adopted, and this also presented a massive brick wall, as adoption records are not accessible to genetic genealogists. It seemed like Julie had been adopted at the age of 5, and often adopted children are entirely removed from their communities of birth and they have their names changed, so they were now looking for another name on top of the name they were already looking for. According to the DNA Doe Project, it was clear from early on that she had strong genetic ties to Kentucky, but they didn't know if she was born there or if she ever even lived there. But while searching through county records from Fayetteville County, they discovered the names of two key genetic relatives who became crucial to unravelling this mystery. It became known at that point that Pamela had indeed grown up with her adopted family in Kentucky, and she had officially changed her name by the time she was in her mid-20s, which was likely around the same time she went through all of her surgeries. I'm not entirely sure if they found out what her chosen name was at this point, Pamela Walton, but I would assume not, because in 2024, DNA Doe Project conducted a massive media outreach campaign to try and get tips in from the public who might have known Julie, as she was known then, in life. But even this had added complications, because in their press release for this case, the DNA Doe Project have called out Meta for what seems to be quite blatant censorship on the platform. The Facebook posts, which they were boosting into Kentucky and Florida, which are two states where Pamela clearly had links, kept being reported as misleading and spam, which would cause Meta to remove the posts and cancel the ads before they even had a chance to run in the places where people likely would have known who Julie was. Meta would review them, the posts would be reinstated, and then the same would happen just hours later. Apparently this cycle went on for weeks, and the support person at Meta did acknowledge that it was because they were boosting a transgender case into a place where there's a high anti-trans sentiment. And Meta eventually just recommended that the DNA Doe Project change the post entirely to omit any mention of Julie being a transgender woman, and to boost the post instead into areas of the US which were more trans-friendly, but this simply wasn't acceptable. Correct me if I'm wrong, it's just pure bigotry, blatant transphobia from people who see a transgender post and automatically report it, and cowardice from Meta, who refuse to stand their ground and just keep letting it get reported. Pamela Ritson, the Executive Director of Media and Communications at the DNA Doe Project, told ForensicMag.com, "Julie Doe was marginalised and eventually murdered, dying without her name. I will not give Meta a pass for their abhorrent behaviour. No matter how many times the ad is rejected or thwarted, I will not stop advocating for Julie, and I will continue to push to get her story into the public view. I mean, what's the point in trying to promote this case into areas which are more trans-friendly in the USA? Because that's not where Julie was from, that's not where people are going to know her. She was known in Kentucky and in Florida. That is where the case, the post, needs to be seen." All of this is just a sobering reminder of the echo chamber of social media, because from my end, it looked like everyone was desperate to see this case solved. I've probably seen more people talking about this case, about Julie Doe, than any other Doe case online in the last couple of years. But apparently that is not the case internet-wide. I also do have to pretty often delete wildly offensive comments on that video, or my original Julie Doe video, so I'm not surprised. Whilst the DNA Doe Project were able to get this case featured in a number of high-end publications, in the end it was just their hard work that got this case solved. It wasn't publicity, it wasn't the public coming forward, although that probably would have made it a hell of a lot easier. As Emily Bill, the investigative genetic genealogist, said, their efforts laid the foundation for a series of recent discoveries that finally led to her name, Pamela Lee Walton. Pamela had a very difficult time in life. Her story followed the same lines of many trans people in this time. There were slurs written in high school yearbooks about her. There were doodles over her face. There was a headstone marking her disappearance / presumed death, pre-carved with her dead name. The community, her family it seems, were not willing to accept her and her identity. Even in death, or presumed death I assume by her family, she was misnamed. I don't know the situation around her disappearance, I don't know what led to her family creating a headstone for her, but I do know she was from Carlisle, Kentucky, and we don't really have any other information about her life. With her identity comes so many questions about her death, about who is responsible, about who dumped her in the spot where she would later be found, and I don't have any more information about any of that. The Lake County Sheriff's Department, which is where she was found, posted the identification on their Facebook page, stating that it's still unknown how Pamela came to be in Florida, her manner of death remains undetermined, and the Lake County Sheriff's Office is continuing their efforts to gather information regarding the circumstances of the death. It can probably be assumed that this was a hate crime, and that does inherently make it a bit more complicated to try and solve, because this may not have been anyone who was known to Pamela in life. But I guess now we just hope and pray that the Lake County Sheriff's Office do their job. We'll see. And to be honest, I haven't seen anything suggesting from them that they're not going to dedicate their time and effort to trying to get this solved, so fingers crossed they will. Hopefully. I really hope they do. Moving on now, I can't remember the last time I filmed an updates episode and I didn't include an update on the Long Island serial killer or the Gilgo Beach killer, But there is a lot going on in this case constantly, ever since Rex Heuermann was arrested and charged with the Gilgo Beach murders. A very quick synopsis of this case: from 1993 till 2011, there were a series of murders on Long Island, with the remains being found in 2010 and 2011 during a police search in Gilgo. The remains of four victims were found on Gilgo Beach within a quarter of a mile of each other, and that is Megan Waterman, Melissa Barthelemy, Amber Costello, and Maureen Brainard Barnes. Rex Heuermann was charged with all four of those murders, as well as the murders of Jessica Taylor, Sandra Costilla, and the most recent in December being Valerie Mack. Heuermann reportedly kept detailed notes about these murders on a device found in his Long Island home, which I assume was maybe a computer, and DNA found on Valerie's remains also matched that of one of Heuermann's family members. Now, this family member is not thought to have been involved in this alleged crime, but the evidence points to the possibility that the murders happened inside the family home where he lived with his wife and two children. In a December hearing, Heuermann did plead not guilty to all of these murders, so there is going to be a very big trial coming up, although a date still hasn't been set for said trial. On the 12th of March, the judge scheduled a pre-trial hearing for the 28th of March, where they're going to determine whether DNA evidence linking Heuermann to hairs found at six of the crime scenes should be deemed admissible. I am filming this before the 28th of March. I'm filming this on the 27th of March, actually. So if there's an update in this, I'll put that in the comments. It does seem like these hairs are a very contentious topic in the case. The defense team has argued that the technique used to obtain the DNA match, which is whole genome sequencing, is not widely accepted by the scientific community and therefore shouldn't be used in this case. But the prosecutors, of course, disagree, saying that the technique is used in a wide variety of scientific and forensic settings. So I guess we're gonna see. It also seems like the defense team want multiple trials in this case, not just one, arguing that the evidence in some of the killings is weaker than in others, and combining these cases could lead to an improper conviction. But the district attorney's office is fighting this request, saying that the victims are inextricably interwoven by geographic proximity, victimology, digital and physical evidence, forensic analysis, and defendant's own planning document. Which I probably would tend to agree with, but hey, I'm not the judge here. It's up to the judge to decide. In addition to the DNA evidence in this case, investigators are said to have also found more evidence in the forms of a significant collection of violent bondage and torture pornography on more than 350 electronic devices seized from the home, dating as far back as 1994. Some of the more violent pornography involved methods consistent with injuries on two of the victims. They've also found burner cell phones which were used to arrange meetings with the victims, and a document that they believe Heuermann used to plan the murders, including lists of supplies like saw, cutting tools, and something labelled as DS, which investigators believe stands for dump sites. Another note they found speaks about how more sleep and noise control could allow for more playtime, so they think this was essentially a blueprint for the murders. I find it fascinating that even with all of this evidence, Heuermann is still pleading not guilty. So I can't wait to see how this plays out in court. This case is heading towards the trial phase. It's not quite there yet, but it's getting there. I also have a smaller update in terms of one of the unidentified victims of the list, which is a woman known as Peaches. She was an unidentified female whose torso was discovered in 1997 in Lakeview in New York. She received her nickname Peaches thanks to a tattoo on her left breast of a heart-shaped piece with a bite taken out of it. And then additional skeletal remains were found in the 2011 searches, which DNA revealed belonged to the same woman. Although there's nothing official, there are whispers online that Peaches may have been identified, but her name is being held back from the public at this time. This could be due to some jurisdictional bureaucracy here, like her remains were found in two different counties and two different states, or it could be that they're trying to connect her case to Heuermann and slap him with another murder charge before they release her name. It could also be that they're still trying to get in contact with her relatives who might not be interested in speaking with law enforcement. But there is also another added complication here in the form of her biological child. Baby Doe was the remains of a female toddler found in 2011. She was wrapped in a blanket and showed no visible signs of trauma, but DNA analysis soon found that she was the biological daughter of Peaches. She was also found wearing gold earrings and a gold necklace, very similar to jewellery that her mother was also found wearing. It could well be that they're holding off on announcing Peach's identity until Baby Doe has also been identified or until her biological father has been found. Now, this is all speculation, of course, but it does seem to be the general consensus online that Peach's has been identified. I guess we just wait and see if they announce it anytime soon. They might not ever announce it, but I assume if there is a trial coming up, they probably would. I don't know. In autumn last year, I shared a massive update in the case of Aisha Degree. 24 years after her disappearance, the case was officially declared a homicide investigation and suspects were named after several searches had been conducted by the FBI and the Sheriff's Office. A family called the Deadmans were named in a search warrant, although they have maintained since they are in no way connected to Aisha's disappearance. On the 13th of February, however, this year, three new search warrants were also executed, focusing in on two of the daughters after a man came forward claiming that he had heard one of these daughters confessing to Aisha's murder at a house party in the mid-2000s. The middle daughter, a woman called Lizzie Desmond, was reportedly very visibly upset at this party and intoxicated before admitting, "I killed Aisha Degree." The witness told investigators that he was confident in his memory and he was 100% positive of those moments, although why he only came forward now, I do not know. Although polygraph tests are not admissible in North Carolina, one was administered to the witness, and for what it's worth, he was said to have passed the test. But like I said, why did he wait so many years to come forward with this information? I don't know. These texts, but there's clearly a lot of anxiety over what's going on. But I do think that anyone would be in the same position, guilty or not, for what it's worth. But clearly the authorities found this interesting enough to include in the warrants though, so who knows? Investigators have said they do believe there's evidence that multiple people engaged in obstruction of justice in connection with Aisha's disappearance. But as it stands, it doesn't seem like any arrests have been made, and it also doesn't seem like there's any more news on the car that was seized back in September. An AMC Rambler that had very similar features to the vehicle always wanted in connection with Aisha's disappearance was taken from the Deadmans property. But there's been nothing about that at all. The Deadmans attorney has said that any connection between the family and the crime is tenuous at best, and I'm not entirely sure what the delay is in any arrests being made here. Clearly the evidence isn't as strong as the authorities would like in this case, or maybe they're waiting on a very specific piece of evidence to come through. I don't know, they've clearly suspected this family. But there's been no arrest, they haven't done anything. And of course, as always, it is innocent until proven guilty. There's nothing at this moment to suggest that they are guilty. Next, I want to talk to you about Jack the Ripper, yet another massive case, probably one of the most famous murder cases of all time, might have been solved, or at least as much as a 136-year-old case can be solved. Maybe. I always take it with a pinch of salt when headlines like these come out because I don't think there's any definitive way to tell at this point, but let me share the details and you can make up your own mind when it comes to Jack the Ripper. Between August and November 1888, a man terrorised the streets of London, brutalising and murdering at least five women, maybe at least six more. Three of the victims had their internal organs removed with seemingly expert precision, leading to speculation over the years that the killer may have been a surgeon or maybe a butcher. They definitely possess anatomical or surgical knowledge. In 2007, a man called Russell Edwards, an author and self-proclaimed ripperologist, purchased a shawl belonging to one of the victims, Catherine Eddowes, complete with blood and semen evidence. Now, of course, all of this raises huge chain of evidence questions, but I suppose that wouldn't have been much of a concern in 1888 anyway. They didn't really know about DNA at this time. But I do think it's right to remain sceptical of evidence from such an old crime scene. But anyway, Russell bought the shawl and put it through forensic testing, where it was found to contain DNA from two separate people, presumably from Catherine herself and from her killer. After a very long 4-year process, they did find that one of the DNA profiles did indeed match a descendant of Catherine Eddowes, whilst the other, the semen, matched the descendants of a man called Aaron Kaminsky, who has long been connected or suspected of the crimes. Kaminsky was a Polish immigrant. He was born in Poland before moving to England with his family as a child, and eventually came to work as a barber in Whitechapel in London. Medical reports showed that he suffered with mental illness since around 1885, when he would have been around the age of 20, and he spent a lot of time in a number of asylums across London. He would experience auditory hallucinations and had a deep fear of being fed by other people, as well as a refusal to wash or bathe. And a refusal to wash or bathe would be bad enough today in London, but that in Victorian London, that doesn't even bear thinking about. He must have stunk, which is probably the least of his problems, to be honest, but even the thought of that, knowing what I know about Victorian London, nope, no thank you. But anyway, I digress. You have got to ask yourself, what are the chances of the DNA on this shawl supposedly matching somebody who had long been a suspect as the Ripper anyway? It does make it seem a bit more viable. We're not talking about just like a random name being pulled from the air here. We're talking about Kosminski, who had long been a suspect. Years after the murders, documents were uncovered that revealed that the police had suspicions at the time against a man called Kosminski. There was no first name, that was all he was known as in the documents. And further investigation by experts over the years narrowed this down to the Aaron Kosminski in question. The Assistant Chief Constable of the London Metropolitan Police in 1894, Sir Melville McNaughton, stated that Kosminski was suspected because he had a great hatred of women with strong homicidal tendencies. So he had clearly been a suspect since the early days, and now here they've allegedly found his DNA on one of the victim's shawls. But even then, if we are to believe the DNA testing, the presence of his semen on the shawl doesn't necessarily mean that he was the killer. Catherine Eddowes was likely a sex worker. Could it be that he had simply been one of her clients and all of this is just a big, massive coincidence? It's unlikely, but his semen being there doesn't necessarily mean that he is the killer. So yeah, as you can see, this isn't an official identification by any means. The testing process has been disputed by some scientists and the research has not yet been published in scientific peer-reviewed journals, so it can't be independently verified. But it might be the closest that we're ever going to get. Law here in the UK states that it's up to the Attorney General to approve a further inquest into this case, the latest of which was denied just 2 years ago, saying there wasn't sufficient new evidence. And I guess we can only officially say this case is solved once that has happened and the law officially puts the case to rest. And honestly, I don't see that happening anytime soon. It's likely not worth spending the money on at this point. So I don't think we're ever going to be able to say this case is solved. And I think with the chain of evidence problems, the shawl being passed down from God knows where to God knows who, I don't think it can be used by modern day standards as evidence in this case. I just don't think it can. But maybe it would be. I don't know. It's up to the Attorney General to decide. Next up, I have a rather frustrating update for you in the case of Evelyn Cologne. She was murdered in 1976 along with her unborn daughter, and her remains were found on the banks of the Lehigh River in Carbon County, Pennsylvania, packed into several suitcases and seemingly just tossed, discarded off a bridge. Despite an intensive investigation, the authorities couldn't find any name for her, and she was buried 7 years later under the name of Beth Doe. It wouldn't be until 44 years later that she would finally be identified as 15-year-old Evelyn of Jersey City, New Jersey, when a relative's DNA profile struck a match with hers. With her identification, it became clear that there was an obvious suspect in this case, her then-boyfriend, Luis Sierra. Family members have said that they received a letter from Evelyn after her disappearance, saying that she had simply moved away and she had given birth to a baby boy, naming him Luis Sierra Jr. However, the fetus found with Evelyn's remains was that of a female. She had never been expecting a baby boy when she disappeared, so even if she did run away and start a new life elsewhere, there was never a reason for her to lie in this letter and say she had given birth to a boy. You would at least expect her to be honest about the sex, and that leads people to believe that Evelyn was never the one that wrote this letter. Pennsylvania State Police did interview Sierra, who is now 67 years old, at his home in 2021 and soon charged him with homicide. However, he has been out on bail since 2022. But earlier this month, it was announced that the charge had been dismissed in Carbon County due to potential jurisdictional issues. Carbon County District Attorney Michael Grieg said, during the course of this investigation, it was determined the alleged crime most likely took place in Jersey City, New Jersey. Because of that, the charges are being dismissed here. Now, the wording of this feels very intentional. They do make a point to say the charges haven't been dropped because they don't think Sierra did it, or because the evidence isn't there. The charges were dropped because of jurisdictional issues that may arise at trial. Now, I don't know if that means that he is going to be rearrested by the Jersey City authorities instead, but it doesn't seem like this has happened yet, if it is going to happen. It will be incredibly frustrating if Evelyn never sees any justice because of bureaucracy, but that might be the way this case goes. Again, it's just another case of waiting and seeing what happens. I do also have an update for you in the case of the Beaumont children, which is potentially Australia's most famous ever missing persons case. It consists of three siblings, Jane, Anna and Grant Beaumont, who disappeared from near Glenelg Beach near Adelaide on the 26th of January 1966 in a suspected abduction and murder. Over the past 59 years, there have been countless searches for these children. It received worldwide attention, but there has never been a single clue as to what happened to them. They literally just disappeared. The latest search happened in just the last couple of months, a 7-day search at the site where it's long been rumoured that the children were buried, the old Castelloy factory site. Starting on the 22nd of February, almost 10,000 tonnes of soil were dug up at this site, with local MP Frank Pangello saying it was one of the biggest clandestine grave digs in the world. They had a local earth-moving firm, as well as two forensic archaeologists present, but nothing was found. There wasn't a single sign of the children. Pangello said that whilst the unsuccessful search was obviously very disappointing, it had generated a renewed interest in this cold case, and as a result, fresh information has come to light. He said, "There has been some significant information that has been passed on to me from incredibly credible people. I've already spoken to Major Crime and I gave my assurance that any information we have gleaned and people would like me to pass on will be passed on to the South Australian Police." So perhaps this is a non-update update, a massive search that led to nothing once again, but it does mean that the Castelloy site can perhaps now be disregarded as a burial site for the children, focuses can stop being on the area. But can they be found after 59 years? Is it possible? I suppose you don't know until you try. Last October, literally days after I posted my last case updates video, news came out about potential updates in the case of Dalique Rainwalker. The 12-year-old vanished in November 2007 from his adoptive parents. He'd spent 6 days in respite care before being picked up by his adoptive father, Stephen Kerr. They then drove to Stephen's father's house to stay the night, before the next day he reports Dalique as a runaway, and he's never been seen since. But of course, authorities nowadays don't believe that Dalique ran away. Evidence shows that his home life was not happy. In October last year, so 17 years since Dalique's disappearance, skeletal remains were found in Troy, New York, an area near where police had already searched for Dalique in mid-2022 following a very strong tip. And then less than 2 years later, non-adult human remains were then discovered in the area, in a wooded area next to Burden Pond Reserve. It was natural to assume that these remains might have been Dalique's. However, it was sadly soon found that this was not the case. Preliminary analysis found them inconsistent with Dalique, and then dental comparisons confirmed that it was not him. I couldn't find confirmation whether they did actually find who these non-adult skeletal remains belonged to. I don't know if they released it. But that was a very big couple of days in this case. A lot of people really thought that it must be him, and it wasn't. Today, Dalique would be 29 years old. He is biracial with very distinctive green eyes. This case was reclassified as a presumed homicide in 2012, but there is no actual evidence that Dalique is dead. However, the general consensus is that they do not believe the adoptive father's story that he ran away. I do hope Dalique ran away, his home life was really, really poor, but the chances are slim because where would a 12-year-old have gone? Chances are he is not with us anymore, that something happened to him. And I really feel like this is a case that just is not spoken about enough, is not known enough. Where is Dalique Rainwalker? And the final update I have for you is the Menendez brothers. There was a massive surge in interest in the Menendez brothers' case last year after a wildly popular TV show about their case became one of the most popular series of 2024. Lyle and Eric Menendez murdered their parents, Jose and Kitty, at their home, but their defense argued that this murder came after decades of sexual abuse at the hands of their father. And this has been an incredibly divisive case ever since it happened in 1989. People never know what side to believe. Were they abused? Does that make murder understandable? Should they have received a lighter sentencing in light of this? Well, it seems a lot of people do think so, because after the TV show, people rallied and started fighting for their release. And it all became pretty political. The district attorney was up for re-election at this time, and he placed a lot of his campaign around backing resentencing for the brothers. He wanted to change their sentencing to 50 years to life instead of their current sentencing of life in prison, which would have meant they were immediately eligible for parole. However, the DA lost the election, and his replacement, DA Nathan Hochman, has said he does not support resentencing because the brothers have repeatedly lied about the events of the murder. Having the DA advocate for you is pretty powerful in situations like this, and without the DA backing you, it's a lot more difficult. Hochman, the new DA, has told reporters that his decision to not support resentencing hinges on the fact that the brothers have failed to take complete responsibility for the lies they told. He also said that their argument they shot their parents in self-defense simply does not match with the facts of the case, which show premeditated steps taken beforehand. He has said that he would support resentencing if the brothers finally come clean with the court, with the public, with the DA's office, with their own family members, and acknowledge all of their lies. However, the family members, the Justice for Eric and Lyle Coalition, said in a statement, "Let's be clear, Eric and Lyle are not the same young boys they were more than 30 years ago. They have apologised for the horrific actions they took. They have apologised to us. And they have demonstrated their atonement through actions that have helped improve countless lives. Yet DA Hochman is effectively asking for them to publicly apologise to a checklist of actions they took in a state of shock and fear." So basically, the family have asked that Hochman be removed from the case. They've cited bias, and the DA has rejected that claim, obviously. There was due to be a hearing in late March to basically look at all of this again in a court setting. It doesn't look like that has happened. I was googling it just before I filmed this video. I couldn't find any more information on it. So as it stands, that's where we're at. If that hearing does happen in the next few days before this video is live, again, I'll put an update in the comments. For a second there, it really did look like the brothers were about to be released. And I think if the old DA hadn't lost his re-election campaign, they probably would have been released by now, or at least on the way to being released. But clearly, that's not happening, so I guess we just continue to wait and see. The Menendez brothers are just one of those cases where I've never quite known where I stand. I don't know what to believe. Although I must admit, the evidence that has come out in the last 6 months or so does make me more likely to believe their version of events. But even then, I just don't know with this case. I have no idea. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.